All right. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. Thank you for joining us. I am your host, Jason Napolitano. I'm the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And I have on the phone in the background, banging around, Mr. Chris Sheridan, the author of The Spirit in the Sky. What's up?
Just banging around here.
That's all.
What else would I be doing?
Exactly. Right. So hopefully,
probably the microphone works.
That's the important thing to know. The microphone, in fact, is working. As is mine, although I haven't hit it on anything yet. So okay. I will throughout the show.
Try it.
Let's see.
That feel better.
It really does make you feel good to just know that you're alive by banging a microphone around.
Sure.
All right, so today we are going to discuss The Occult Anatomy of Man by Mr. Manly P. Hall. If you listen to the podcast with any sort of regularity, you will know that Manly P. Hall is one of Chris and mine. I don't have to break out the grammar book for that one. He's one of our idols.
Yes.
We both worked at PRS, at the Philosophical Research Society, which is the organization that Manly Hall started in L.A., which still exists today, in Los Feliz in L.A. Our shout out to them. Hey, PRS.
Hey, PRS.
How you guys doing?
All right.
But Chris and I were there many years ago. Chris was there a lot longer than I was. I worked in the bookstore, and Chris, you worked in the academic and kind of like administrative portion of the place.
Wore many hats for many
years.
With
many years, indeed. But both of us count that as one of our prize times in life. I mean, it was very, very cool to be there.
Well, throw this in.
Yeah, please.
What was cool about being there, not just because it was a neat place, started in really the fantastic library that I think is still accessible today, which is great. It was, for me, I'm throwing this in, it was after years of just kind of randomly studying or going to retreats or to Sedona or, reading metaphysical books for many, many years, or the Tao of Physics, or, Zen meditation in, the 80s. It was a place where you could go to, or it was like an organization that, okay, everything made sense there.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
It
was a place doing,
together,
I wasn't just some
it?
Random, oddball studying on my own. This is like, oh my gosh, I can use all this stuff I've been, as a hobby studying. It was like, wow, this is good. They're doing it here.
Good point. And you actually had the good fortune of finishing their master's degree program when that was available. And that's a fantastic thing. So the other side of it, I think that, that's so cool about Mr. Hall's work is, He's best known, if you're not familiar, please do go back and listen to some of our other podcasts. Our very first podcast that we did is actually get an overview of Manly Hall and his most famous book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. But what's so great about it really is he's very much like Jung or Joseph Campbell or Mircea Eliade, in that he tries to really find the kind of hidden source wisdom behind the surface mythology and the surface symbolism that exists in different traditions, and kind of goes back to the root of it and helps to find those unifying elements that are in all of them, particularly focused on the Western mystery traditions, that of ancient Greece and Rome and the early mystery schools, Freemasonry and this sort of thing in the West. But also he studied Buddhism and Zen, and spoke about everything from Japanese flower arranging to, different philosophy, Kundalini and yoga, which, we'll talk a little bit about Kundalini today. But anyway, that kind of contextualizes Mr. Hall and his work. I'll contextualize the book, The Occult Anatomy of Man, and why we thought it would be a good one to talk about. Today, there's obviously a lot of interest in this type of material, but then there's also sort of this cross current of materialism that we often talk about, and this sort of scientific materialist point of view that seems to be so prevalent today with the new atheists and some of the neuroscience movements and so on. And it's not to knock those things; they're fine, and they certainly have their place. And they're one way of looking at things, but the other way of looking at things is this more ancient way. Let's say if the materialist point of view is that consciousness is created by the brain, and that it's just a random product of evolutionary processes that, you know, come to their pinnacle peak in the human development in our brain. And then of course, you know, that consciousness and all this creativity and all this stuff that we do as human beings comes out of that energy that's created basically by the brain and by the energies that are within us. Versus the ancient point of view would be, well, the body and the brain are like the house or the temple that contain the soul, contain the consciousness, which is actually a closer in view to the Eastern point of view, particularly that of India. But we're looking at things in this book from that ancient point of view, where the body is actually thought of as a temple. It's seen as a receptacle of consciousness and kind of the vehicle for this higher self, which sort of rides in this animal body. Basically, they're connected, they're intimately and, you know, integratively connected. But the consciousness is not a product of the body or the brain by any means. And, you know, it's interesting because I talked a little bit about this with Chris before the show. There's a saying in the Gospel of Thomas, actually saying 29, Jesus says in that text, if the flesh came into being because of spirit, it is a wonder. But if spirit came into being because of the body, it's a wonder of wonders. It's a wonder of wonders. So, you know, that idea was even being explored back, you know, 18 or 1900 years ago when this Gospel of Thomas was written. So pretty interesting stuff. So anyway, on to the book. So we're going to talk about, as I said, the occult anatomy of man. And basically, it's a book about the human body, symbolism, mythology, and so on, and how these things are related. So, you know, Manly Hall first kind of lays it out where he talks about how God made man in his own image. And we see that in Genesis, of course, where God said, let us make man in our own image after our own likeness. So, I mean, it begins in the very, you know, beginning of Western scripture right there. In Kabbalah, the ancient hidden wisdom of Israel, the human body is seen as a microcosm, a little cosmos, which is made in the image of the macrocosm or the great cosmos. And that is this ancient view, basically, in a nutshell, that we're sort of a reflection of the higher. And, you know, we see and experience the higher through our own body and through our own experiences in this sort of imperfect way, but one that's definitely connected to our higher creative sources. You know, and one of the things that Manly Hall does a really good job of in this book is pointing out how the sacred stories and mythologies of most lands and cultures can be understood as allegories and metaphors for functions of the body, attributes of the mind, and qualities of the soul, so that you can really see in these different stories things that are going on within yourself. You know, I think of, if you think of a lot of the stories from the Bible, you know, oftentimes do have historical antecedents as well. But if you look at them from a more, metaphorical point of view, we can see those characters as different parts of ourselves. For example, if you want to look at psychology, and see things unfolding in that direction, that's another way to look at things. The Hermetic wisdom, of course, from Hermes, from the Emerald Tablet, that which is above is like unto that which is below, and that which is below is like unto that which is above, is another way of looking at things. So, you know, really, we're looking at just kind of a different way. It's a different framing. It's almost a turning back to the source. You know, you could say in a lot of ways that the, you know, the scientific revolutions and the rational age turned us in on ourselves in a way, and then we became the source of all these things, and a sort of grandiosity developed in a lot of ways, where man began to think of himself as the kind of creator and the there was no higher source and no sort of higher laws to really govern man any longer. And when you see what kind of came out of that, you can look at some of the destructive nature of that turning back towards ourselves and not seeing ourselves as having some kind of origin, more higher outside ourselves, I guess you could say, in the different, you know, wars that have happened, the atrocities that have occurred and so on, that have been enabled by our technological advances in a lot of ways. So we, while we, advanced technologically and scientifically and medically and academically and so on, you know, philosophically speaking and in the heart area, you know, we haven't necessarily advanced as far as we need to with all of these new advances in technology. So what we're aiming to do is to kind of go back to a more ancient point of view to look at these things from a higher perspective. In other words, like, I'm not creating, you know, my consciousness from my brain or my body, but in fact, you know, I'm reflecting the consciousness of something greater than myself, let's say. And it, you know, it kind of puts things in a different perspective when you look at it like that. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I do. And, you know, there's also the notion of the transmission theory that we are like a radio, that we're not the radio station. We're not, you know, we do broadcast as well, but we're as much a receptive or relay station of consciousness and the ether. And we are maybe a localized sort of receptacle container of that. You know, and then we can kind of put our own spin on it, but we're a part of this larger sense. And that's in what you mentioned about technology, the advances in technology in recent centuries, let's say, and certainly in recent decades, has far outpaced advances made in ethics and morality and consciousness from humans and exactly. individuals and
yeah,
groups.
For sure.
As a matter of fact, some of the ethical things, you know, these ancient wisdom sources, we're still struggling with those things, or we're ignoring those things, or we're sometimes doing really well with those things.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be a tendency to jump on the, because we live in a technological age, and that seems to be, you know, our new or current anyway. Oh, this is the next, this is the big thing. This will solve, and it does solve many problems. Technology and advances mm-hmm. With devices and things have allowed us to do, you know, some really incredible things and some incredibly horrible things, because we haven't, we've been given this knowledge without also developing maybe the new set of rules.
Yeah.
We know how
to
use it, but we don't know how to use ourselves in relation to these things.
Good point. Yeah, exactly.
And the same thing with our body. And this, I think what this, you know, cult anatomy is really is talking about is, you know, metaphysical healing in the sense that you have to understand, here's like the anatomy class for, you know, metaphysical medical school.
Yeah.
You know, and this, you know, this is kind of the body, this is the functioning. And then for the purpose of healing, I think that's one of the main goals of approaching the body this way,
definitely.
Is to help with the healing process and to live, you know, harmoniously so you don't get sick in the first place versus
sure.
the rush to just go to some get the procedure, get the test, get the pill, get the this.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, look at everything and use all the tools that we can. Why not? There's ancient tools that work
exactly
fantastically well.
And then, I mean, another goal of understanding this sort of occult anatomy and some of these different ideas is that, you know, the ancient priests particularly realized that the path or the path to salvation or realization or enlightenment or whatever you want to call it required an understanding of the occult functions of the human body. By occult, we're using the terminologies of hidden secret wisdom. The word esoteric could also be used. So it's nothing evil. You know, some people get the wrong idea when they hear the word occult these days and they think that it has something to do with a horror movie or something. And, you know, I just wanted to make that clear. But these are just different functions that really science doesn't recognize yet or may never recognize, things that go on within the body that are invisible to us in terms of our material sciences, basically. And these are the processes that, you know, that we find this wisdom and we are able to cultivate these different qualities and energies and psychological capacities within ourselves with. And so an understanding of the way that ancient people saw these things, you know, really does give us a great benefit even today. I mean, even if, you know, if materially speaking, these different ideas can't necessarily be substantiated, quote unquote, by science, it doesn't mean that they're not valid and it doesn't mean they don't, you know, exist. That's one thing we have to remember. I mean, some things, you know, yeah, that we have, you know, are considered superstitious now. We can see that that wasn't necessarily the way things operate or what, you know, whatever. But some of these fundamentals, that they still apply, they're still important, and they're still bringing people comfort and healing and enlightenment to this day. And those are the things that, you know, that we're going to talk about. So getting into this a little bit. So in the occult tradition, first of all, and I mean that the Western sort of hermetic and alchemical and magical traditions, for the most part, there's an idea that all the sacred writings, and that goes for, you know, the Bible and, you know, both Torah and New Testament, and, you know, various other sacred writings throughout the world, they're all supposed to be sealed with seven secret seals. You even get that idea in Revelation, the seven seals comes through. And so basically this means that there's sort of seven levels to understanding any kind of scripture. And this Manly Hall points out is that, you know, it doesn't really explicitly say this in the book itself, but I mean, he points at it and you've kind of got to figure it out. It's, you know, it's pointing to the chakras really, and the different levels of consciousness that exist within us. Those are also known as the seven ancient planets in the Western tradition, and or the interior stars. We're going to get into that a little bit later, but I just wanted to point that out, that you really need these different seven levels of understanding to really go deeply into any kind of wisdom. But how that's analogous and sort of metaphorical with the body is that, you know, you see that the wisdom itself in these books is sealed with seven seals, and we ourselves are sealed with seven seals essentially interiorly. And so that, you know, you see that metaphor work there, and those all need to be opened up in order to have understandings and different transcendent, you know, visions and understandings and qualities that arise in us. So that's one thing we need to look at first off. Like I said, we're going to talk about the seven planets a little bit more later. I'm kind of following my notes here because this one is so packed with stuff that, you know, Chris and I were talking about this before. We were saying, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to get this into one show. And I think we're actually going to do a series of probably four or five lectures on this that might include videos and so forth. So look forward to that. We'll tell you more about that in the future. So the first sort of section of this book is the three worlds that Manly Hall gets into. And this is where he kind of likens the exterior world and the interior worlds and human life and, you know, the mysteries of the cosmos to these three levels of existence and understanding. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I feel like I'm going on and on. I want to give you some space to share your thoughts too. So you want to cover those three?
The three worlds?
The three worlds, yeah. Yep, exactly.
Well, it's basically heaven, the middle ground, earth, and hell, if you want to look at the larger metaphor for those three worlds. Mm-hmm. And with the body, you have the head being, you know, higher up, more towards the spiritual. And then in the lower, you have the generative and, you know, orifices of the body, you know, so you have this lower, you know, more towards the bottom where the earth is. And then in the middle, this middle ground is the spinal column that connects the two and connects all the extremities and the blood flow and everything else that goes to the rest of the body. But he goes into detail in the following three chapters on just what these three things are. You know, the next three chapters are basically each one devoted towards that, but they're all very, think of any other kind of Trinity, you know, in the Hindu tradition, you know, with Brahma and Vishnu and Shiva, with body, mind, soul, things like that. I think that's, you know, the symbolism of what he's getting at there. And, but just kind of look at ourselves in that threefold way. And just as a system of symbols, we use this kind of in our everyday language anyway, at least to some degree. We say, things at the head office are all balled up today.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or you go deep into the bowels of the steamship. They were shoveling coal into the furnace. You know, it's like you use this language anyway, because it's the body, and it's one of the tools, one of the things that we have. And it's one of the things we can really get to know, but really get to know in another way. I mean, our decimal system is based on the fact that we have 10 fingers on average. You know, it's so pervasive, you know, headquarters, you know, headquarters, sure. Not foot quarters, a foot soldier. He's at the lowest end of the spectrum, and headquarters. It's silent, or maybe it's, we don't notice it because it's so much part of our language, but it's so much deeper than that. And that's what we're getting into.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where I was talking about at the beginning, where, you know, I think today we're more apt to think like we came up with those sayings based on the body and based on our experiences in the world, but we really didn't. I mean, the ancients came up with these ideas based on these bigger spiritual and metaphysical ideas of, you know, heaven, earth, and the underworld as being the model that they were kind of dealing with, and the head, the spinal column, or the sort of mid portion of the body. And then the underworld being the generative function, as you said. And, you know, you look at it on the spine, and then of course that's the, you know, the lower chakra, the middle chakra, and the head, or the third eye, or Sahasrara, which is on the top of the head, the seventh chakra. You know, those are all that would be the heaven portion of it. But so I think that, you know, we tend to think of it as, you know, from the body point of view, and they use those terminologies, but they also understood that they corresponded to those bigger ideas and those spiritual ideas. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It wasn't just the day to day. Maybe that's all that's left right now. It's sort of the day to day use of it. And maybe what, you know, we're getting at is to really get excited again about these larger ways of looking at all our little parts, as well as the body as a whole.
Yeah.
The mystery in every single one of them.
Exactly. I love the way too that he, this is getting a little bit off topic, but it made me think of it. So he talked about how the human body itself is like a universe within, and, you know, when we make a choice to walk down the street, for example, we're moving a whole universe or a whole cosmos with us, you know. And he talked about the different kingdoms and nations and all this that are within us, and, you know, within, you know, the cells and the different parts of our structure. And when you think about that, I mean, it really is like, you can see where they made this analogy, the microcosm to the macrocosm, because the actual human body, you know, run by the consciousness, the sort of I am consciousness, which is within us, you know, is like that. It is like that. I mean, you are literally moving around this massive formation of these billions of processes and billions of cells and billions of bacterium. And, you know what I mean? It's really amazing and mysterious when you think about it, but we take it for granted when we look at it like a machine in a lot of ways. Well, it's just, you know, like, and what the doctor is like a mechanic, like a car mechanic or something. And there is that, you know, there is that element to the body. I mean, obviously if your hand gets cut off, you need to, you know, if it's possible, you know, reattach it with some very, you know, technologically advanced tools and things like that. And those analogies are not, you know, completely out of place. But when you look at the totality of it and the mystery of being and the mystery of how it all functions together and everything that's going on at any given moment within us, literally, you know, millions or billions of different things are happening at any given time, and we have no conscious knowledge of any of them. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, the white blood cells that are, you know, protecting us from germs, and, you know, and the blood pumping, the heart pumping, the blood moving, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's just, it's incredible when you really think about the intelligence.
Well, it's overwhelming.
It is.
Think about it.
But the you know, the instinctual and autonomous processes that are occurring, you know, really is, it's remarkable. It's remarkable. And I think that the ancients had much more reverence and respect for them, even though they didn't have as great of a scientific or material understanding of them. They still sensed all of these different things going on within and saw some of these things, you know, I would say intuitively or clairvoyantly, you might say, because they still, you know, they still hold true in this occult anatomy and some of these metaphysical ideas. So, Anyway, moving on, I wanted to talk a little bit too about how you're talking about the I want to read something actually from Manly Hall so we can get a flavor from this book. He talks about the Trinity, and they're talking about that with that three worlds concept. So I'm going to read this. Is from page 16, and he says, "The Trinity in man lives in the three great chambers of the human body from which they radiate their power throughout the three worlds. These centers are the brain, the heart, and the reproductive system. These are the three main chambers of the pyramid, and also the rooms in which are given the entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason degrees of the Blue Lodge Masonry." That's Freemasonry. "In these three chambers dwell the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, who are symbolized by the three-letter word Om, A-U-M. The transmutation, regeneration, and unfoldment of these three great centers result in the sounding of the lost word, which is the great secret of the Masonic order. From the spinal nerves come impulses and life forces which make this possible." So, you know, you see in that a lot of those ideas that you see in the East as well, in yoga philosophy and Hinduism and so forth. And you can see how these ideas cross over. Certainly, but you know, it begins in the body, the process, you know, it's a psycho-spiritual process that goes on in the body. Another neat thing that he talks about is when he's talking about the brain, and this was on 18. I really like this one, and I read these because Manly Hall is such a beautiful way of reading them that I can't possibly summarize them as well as he does. "Every organ of the physical body is reproduced in the brain, where it can be traced by the law of analogy. There are two embryonic human forms, one male and the other female, twisted together in the brain. These are the yin and yang of China and the black and white dragons biting each other. One of these figures has its organ of expression in the pineal gland and the other the pituitary body. These two ductless glands are well worth consideration, for they are very important factors in the unfolding of human consciousness. It is known that these glands are larger and more active in higher grades of mentality than those of the lower. These two little glands are called the head and tail of the dragon of wisdom. They are the copper and zinc poles of an electric circuit which has the entire body as a battery." Which has the entire body as a battery. So these occult principles at work here, you know, may or may not conform with some of the ideas in science today, but the symbolic nature and the metaphorical nature of them certainly does. The masculine feminine at work, the yin yang energy and so on, the right and left sides of the brain and all of these sorts of analogous ideas. He talks about the pituitary body, and these, we'll get a little bit into this more when we talk about the spinal column, because we're going to talk about the chakras and the interior planets, as I said, and how these connect together. But the pituitary body is known under the following symbols in the ancient world: the alchemical retort, the mouth of the dragon, the Virgin Mary, the Holy Grail, the lunar crescent, the lava of purification, one of the cherubim of the arch, the Isis of Egypt, the Radha of India, or the fish's mouth. And these are just a few of those symbolic ideas of that sort of that feminine energy or that feminine quality, that sort of archetypal energy that's at work in the body. And then the pineal gland is sort of the opposite and more kind of active part of it. That's the more sort of passive or the kind of receptive in this particular philosophy. So interesting stuff.
Well, it is. And it's, you know, he's going towards magnetism.
Yeah.
And electrical circuits. But if you notice, everything's going the other way. It's starting from the body and the symbolism and its function and its purpose. And then it gets applied to a machine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Whereas it's kind of today, we see these machines and we know how they work. And then we go, oh, gosh, our body's kind of like that.
Yeah.
And we treat our bodies like a machine. It used to be we would treat our creations, our machines, like there was some human life to them, or they were anthropomorphic in some way.
Yeah.
I've heard this in other lectures of Manly Hall, and I don't really have a pinpoint on this actual source, but he's mentioned more than once in some of the audio lectures that there isn't anything that we make. And he used the example of a car that wasn't first a successful one, like successful airplane or car, cannot come into being if it doesn't have those qualities that are in the human body or in nature unto itself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you think of the two headlights in the car, there's an electrical system, there's the fluids, and then there's, you know, the sensors, and it's got 4 feet like a cheetah or a mm-hmm. jaguar, and then the car jaguar has, you know, it's very yeah. much, you know, the drivetrain, you know, it needs fuel and it spits out exhaust. I mean, it's,
well, yeah, I think we've forgotten that, haven't we?
That's how those things were invented. That's yeah. why they could have been invented. Exactly. We were the model first. Now we're using our machines as the model to try to apply it to, well, this is kind of, now I will say one thing about the machine approach mm-hmm. to the human body from my experience. And I broke my back. We can get into that in the spinal cord, spinal column thing. I have a kind of a bizarre experience with that, but anyway, it focuses your attention, your consciousness towards that, at least for a while, is that the more mechanical the damage is to your body, if there's like an injury, mm-hmm. the better a mechanistic approach will work.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
A broken leg, broken foot, you put a pin in it, put a plate in it, a metal mechanical thing. You know, they work great. I've had metal rods in my back for over 25 years, and I'm holding up fine.
Yeah, exactly.
But it didn't solve the paralysis. It mm-hmm. solved the structural break in my body, but it didn't solve the nerve damage. So the electrical system
we're
still working on that. Exactly. And it's mysterious. Yeah. The mind and the body. You're talking about that connection between the mind and, you know, the body. How does consciousness work through the brain? How does spirit connect with matter? How does my mind motivate my body? And where's that not hooked up?
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, so just to put a cap on that, mechanistic approach works for mechanistic issues.
Yeah, for sure.
Most of our issues are probably, other than some injuries, obvious injuries.
Yeah, earlier, if your hand is, you know, if you've cut your hand off, or, you know, you've got a dislocated shoulder, or, you know, your arm is broken, you know, they have tremendous ways of treating these injuries, for example. But then, you know, if it involves any sort of psychological or spiritual dilemma or anything that's sort of multifaceted, oftentimes the sort of mechanistic approach is ineffective. It may solve one problem and it may cause, you know, 5 others, you know, that drug or that particular surgical procedure or whatever that's being performed to try to, quote unquote, heal the problem. And that's where, you know, you go to a shaman or a priest for what a shaman or a priest can help you with. And you go to a Western medical doctor for what a Western medical doctor can help you with. And you go to a psychologist for what, you know, he or she can help you with. And, you know, that's kind of the way we've got to approach these things. It'd be nice if they would speak to each other more and we'd be able to put, you know, kind of a holistic veneer on the whole thing. But,
well, they used to be one and the same.
Yeah,
the shaman,
exactly.
The witch doctor, the medicine, the faith healer. It was a spirit, a scientist, a pharmacologist, a psychologist. They were everybody wrapped up into one. The seers, the astronomers were also philosophers. I mean, there wasn't separation.
It's true. It's true. And they had a spiritual backing and a spiritual sort of framework for looking at things, even if they were doing, more material oriented sort of healing. But maybe that's where, you know, the balance comes in our modern world, as we start to reincorporate some of these more esoteric ideas along with the scientific knowledge that we have and kind of make space for that. That might be
use the best of everything.
Right. So, Hopefully we can work on that. So speaking of spinal stuff, you mentioned that your spinal injury. Speaking about the spinal column, this is gonna be kind of the last section of stuff we're gonna have time to speak about. So the spinal column is the connector between the two worlds, basically the world above and the world below. So heaven and the underworld or hell, in the body and the head, or the sexual center, in that framework. In essence, and that of course is along that spinal column. An interesting thing is the spinal column itself has 33 segments. There's a lot of symbolism, obviously, in the occult wisdom, particularly in Freemasonry, 33rd degree Mason. You know, there's a 33 rung ladder that you're climbing, and these sorts of ideas, and those have to do with that probably with the connection to that spinal column, and a hint that, you know, that energy resides in there. Before they were able to speak about these sort of things publicly, you know, and a lot of this wisdom is now, you know, it's been veiled for so long that oftentimes even the members of these societies like Freemasons and so on, a lot of them don't know about these kinds of things unless they read Manly Hall or they go back and, you know, read Albert Pike and some of the older writers and stuff. And, you know, the Freemasons oftentimes, it turns into kind of more of a social group in some ways. It still has all the elements of the, you know, the secret society stuff at work, but sometimes I think, you know, you've got to do some extra digging to find this stuff. And maybe they do that on purpose. You know, it's hard to say. At any rate, the point is that, you know, this 33 is there, and that's an interesting thing. But the spinal cord is often called in occult literature or mythology, a serpent wand or scepter symbolized by those images. You see that with the Caduceus wand of Hermes, which if you've seen it, it's the wand that has the snakes running up it and the wings at the top of it. And then there's a round ball on the top. And that is, that's symbolic of that spinal cord. And then it ties into the Indian system of yoga as well. It comes out of Greece, that symbol, but, you know, the Greeks obviously visited India and either they borrowed it from them or came up with it on their own. But there's the idea of in India, that the energy, the Kundalini energy, moves up the spine. It comes up through there's three channels, basically. There's Sushumna, which runs up the middle, and there's Ida and Pingala, which run up the sides, and they snake up and then they cross over. So they start each on one side, they snake up and they cross over at the points where the chakras are, basically. And you can see that in that Caduceus wand. And if you've never seen one, look it up. It's C-A-D-U-C-E-U-S, Caduceus, is that right? C-A-D-U-C-E-U-S.
It's the medical symbol.
It's the medical symbol.
Most doctors and medical associations use.
It's on the side of ambulances as well, usually.
Well, that's the Asclepius one. That's the single snake.
Oh, that's right.
It's really interesting.
That's a good call.
How that, they sorted that out. At some point, somebody said, okay, doctors take the hermetic Caduceus, and then the ambulance drivers get the single snake Asclepius.
Good call. Good distinction. I had forgotten that. Yeah.
Yeah, again, something that's, you know, kind of hiding in plain sight that you think of, you recognize, oh, it's a doctor. He's got that thing with the snakes. He didn't even know the snakes. He's got the wings and the staff thing. It's a doctor symbol.
Sure.
But it's, there's mystery there.
Well, and you know, in some of the mythology, there's a point in the Torah where Moses holds up the brazen serpent. It's a brass serpent, or he erects a serpent figure and it heals the people. That's symbolic of that energy. And there's, you know, the Uraeus, that the cobra Uraeus that the pharaohs wore in Egypt, mm-hmm. is symbolic of that. Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent in Mesoamerica. You know, you can see a lot of the dragon symbolism is closely related to the serpent and that energy. So there's, you know, it's throughout our mythology and our stories and our holy scriptures. You know, it's hidden in plain sight, as you said. But once you understand it, you realize, oh, these are processes that also go on within me, as well as, you know, out in this mythical world and, you know, out in the exterior world or spiritual world or what have you. These are things that exist within us as well. Another, you know, interesting point, like I said, I talked about this at the beginning, the sort of idea of the seven seals and these seven ancient planets. Another symbolic aspect of these chakras is the alchemical metals. And these run up through the spine. I mean, most people are familiar with this. It's pretty common knowledge these days, obviously, if anyone's involved with yoga or any of these meditation traditions, or even you've seen it probably on the internet or whatever. It's pretty common knowledge now. You know, in Manly Hall's day, this was not common knowledge. It was still rather hidden, and they were still rather skeptical and fearful of some of these ideas. So he even was pretty, you know, more suggestive, talking about it, not really laying it out. But along the spine is the chakras, or the seven ancient planets, interior stars, or alchemical metals, as they're called in the Western tradition. And again, not all these systems are going to agree with this. This is the one that I found to be useful for myself. And this is one that's found often in Western magic and Rosicrucian traditions and certain forms of alchemy and so on. This is kind of one of the popular ways of looking at this. This isn't really right or wrong ways of assigning planets or metals or colors or whatever to the chakras. I mean, you're going to find, if you work with them, that, you know, different images may come up for you. But these are some that are accepted and are valuable when you're first starting to work with them, I've found in my personal experience. So basically these actually are similar to the way that you see the unfolding of the soul in the Gnostic tradition as well, as it's coming down and putting on heavier and heavier clothing, basically, and becoming more and more material. And this is the way that you would ascend. You come up through, so it starts in Saturn. So Saturn is the planet of the sacral plexus, which is at the base of the spine, and in the yoga tradition, that's called Muladhara, and that's Saturn or lead. That's at the base of the spine. Then Mars is located at the ganglion, below the navel, and that's kind of the sort of physical area. That's that sexual center, and that's called Svadhisthana. That's Mars or iron. Jupiter or tin, that area is basically where what we call the solar plexus, which is kind of a misnomer, because that would denote the sun, but actually Jupiter is there, and that's that solar plexus area is called Manipura in the yoga philosophy. So the sun center is the cardioplexus, and that's the heart area. That's sun or gold, and that's called Anahata. Venus or copper in the alchemical tradition is the nerve center in the throat, or that's Vishuddha. The moon or silver is attributed to the pituitary body, which we were talking about earlier, that sort of feminine receptive quality, that sort of third eye area that's called Ajna, A-J-N-A. And then finally, the Sahasrara, which is the thousand-petaled lotus at the top of the head, more or less where like the soul would enter into the head, is Mercury or Quicksilver, and that's at the cerebrum. And that's where the pineal gland is, and that's considered more of sort of a masculine or initiative sort of an energy, you know, in that sort of masculine-feminine symbolism. So that's the seven planets, and how they run up and down the spine. So the idea is then that Saturn center at the base of the spine, you're bringing this energy up to the third eye, and then it opens up, and then it creates with what would be known as super consciousness or cosmic consciousness. So it's, you know, similar to what goes on in the yoga philosophy. There's different ways to get at it. Some people use tarot. I mean, there's different types of Kabbalistic systems and magic and so on that are used to sort of stimulate these different centers. In the West, though, mostly it's mental exercises and sort of a more of what might be called in India, like jnana yoga, which is sort of like a philosophy or sort of a mental kind of a yoga where, you know, you're working through a lot of this stuff in the mind, a lot of visualization, ritual and things like that, but not really as much direct working on the chakras themselves, although more people are now mixing yoga and magic together. Since we know a lot more about it now, since there's, you know, things have opened up definitely since when Manly Hall wrote this back in the 20s, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing he might have been, and I might be reading between the lines, mm-hmm. Is talking about, and you did mention about directly working on the chakras.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A teacher I had some years ago at PRS, Georgia Lambert, talked about maybe not, depending on how developed mm-hmm. you are, not yeah. directly working on your chakra, like, oh, I'm going to spin it this way and spin it that way, and my red mm-hmm. one and my green one, I'm going to do all this stuff energetically, yeah. making hand motions with, you know, about an inch or two off your belly, you know, circular motions, that instead, maybe, or especially early on, but maybe carry it through as well, see as if there's like a little control panel in front of you, and you see all the seven colors, if you wish, you know, for the corresponding chakras.
Mm-hmm.
And that's coming down from a beam of white light that gets refracted in your head, and it comes out more towards your third eye, and then you see it in front of you. And you see them there like as a control panel. You're working on them remotely, even though you're there. It's a few inches away, I guess. But just in that way, you're looking at the whole picture too, because you can get caught up. Oh, I have so much, you know, anger or something, so I'm going to turn down all my red energy or something.
Mm-hmm.
That can, you might produce an imbalance. So I'm not saying that's what Manuel meant by that, but there is a distinction between working on, just like you would with any kind of remote healing or any kind of sympathetic magic or something. Instead of saying, okay, healing angels, go to my friend in Denver and, you know, make sure her pancreas is okay or whatever. Instead of being so specific about that, be more, okay, healing energy. Here's this person. They are in need. Bring, you know, do the larger thing more on the, instead of really getting in there and meddling, because by doing maybe what you think might be good, it might be upsetting something else, because they're all connected. So
sure,
maybe it's a reminder to look at the system as well as the individual parts. Really, when doing anything, really, you have to look at the details, but you have to look at the big picture. So,
yeah, I think that can be true. And you know, a lot of the Western traditions also kind of do a workaround to this. I know one of the things that I've used in the past and still use actually today is what's known as the middle pillar exercise, and it's a Kabbalistic meditation. Actually, I'm gonna probably do a video or a talk on that one of these days. But it's one where you're basically, instead of working up from the you know, the Saturn or the Muladhara, the base chakra, and pulling the energy up, you actually work down from the top. And so you're drawing the energy down from like a spiritual source and bringing it in. That's considered maybe a safer way of working with this energy at times too. You know, and I don't know, you know, today it's like, we talked about this a little bit earlier today, before the show. Right. And you know, at this time in the 20s, one, they knew much less than they know now about these Eastern practices, and people were much less familiar. So they were actually kind of, you know, going astray, and there were a lot of fake swamis and a lot of people teaching dangerous types of breathing exercises where actually people were getting hurt and, you know, kind of getting whacked out of their minds and stuff. And this is the time when, you know, spiritualism was at a height, and there were a lot of charlatans floating around and people promoting, you know, crazy diets and just weird types of exercises that are actually rather dangerous for people. And I think really that's the place that he's coming from. Not so much like, oh, I'm going to work with a really, you know, legitimate yoga teacher that's teaching Kundalini in a very safe and controlled way and really knows what they're doing, because there really weren't people like that at that time in the U.S. I mean, Yogananda got here in the 20s and began teaching Kriya Yoga and stuff. And you know, I'm trying to think, Vivekananda got here with the Vedanta Society, but he wasn't really teaching, you know, yoga per se. He was teaching yoga philosophy in his book, through his book, Raja Yoga. But it was mostly a style of Jnana Yoga, which is that philosophical yoga. So, you know, it was still developing. It was still developing. And now, you know, we've had teachers for years and years and years, and there are many Western teachers that are quite qualified to teach this now. So, you know, it's a different time and place. But, you know, what I think is, you know, people that tend to be a bit unstable and people that tend to be maybe borderline or have personality disorders or issues, or, you know, people that may tend to fly off into psychotic episodes and things like that. Obviously, you want to be really careful about visualization and working with different energies within the body and so on. It's you know, you're better off probably doing walking meditations where you're just focusing on the earth and trying to connect to the body in a very sane and kind of connected and sort of easy way. Because if you're already prone to, you know, visual sort of having visions and, you know, kind of stepping out of the boundaries of kind of you know, normal consciousness, let's say into, you know, altered states or, you know, altered consciousness, then, you know, you don't really need to use these sorts of methodologies. You need to learn how to do that safely within, you know, with your, you know, psychologist or psychiatrist or with the spiritual guidance of someone who knows how to work with that. But anyway, that's, you know, most of us thankfully don't have to deal with that. So, you know, we can fairly safely work with some of these practices, work with the chakras, work with some of this energy, either coming, you know, down into the body or coming up through the body. And again, this, you know, that goes well beyond the scope of, you know, kind of our introductory discussion here. But we just wanted to kind of really get into the context of this and share some of these ideas from the Occult Anatomy of Man, Mr. Hall's great work, and kind of frame this. I think we're pretty excited about this one. I'm looking forward to delving deeper into this. And I think we're going to do a series on this, right? You want to do that?
Yeah, that sounds good because since it is symbolism, uses actual symbols, imagery.
Yeah.
It would really lend itself to some video, you know, some graphic images of this because those were used so much, you know, the drawings of the great alchemists and just this connection between, you know, our bodies and these larger parts of our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, buildings have been constructed with the main office at the head, you know, and then the wings are different branches, and then people enter through the what would be the feet. It's just
We didn't even talk about that symbolism. The buildings of the temples in the beginning,
the cross,
were laid out with this body, this sacred body symbolism to them. You know, a cathedral was laid out that way. You would walk out. You know, the Holy of Holies and the altar would be where the brain is. Or they'd be shaped like a cross, or, you know, or in the case of the Egyptian temples the Egyptian temple at Karnak. And Mammy Hall talked about some of these ancient Hawaiian practices. They had a temple that was shaped something like the body. And, you know, you can see this in a lot of the stupa that the Tibetans use as not really a temple, but as a representation of the body, you know, and the outline the occult, you know, anatomy more or less of the human body is represented in that stupa that they built.
I think what, you know, the why that we're talking about centers around is that, you know, the body is a temple. Where's your temple in your body? It's right on either side of your head, you know, the straight, narrow, what kind of comes in and goes out. That the body used to be, because it was regarded in, you know, like you said, with reverence and respect.
Yeah.
And that this is this fantastic creation that's kind of a machine. It's kind of a creature. It's kind of something way beyond that.
Yeah.
So much that they did build their temples and the machines and things of life that came out inspired by this thing. Whereas today, it seems, I'm not saying this is the way it's happening everywhere with everyone, mm-hmm. but it seems we've kind of diverged onto two tracks. One is we glamorize the body, that if you look a certain way and you put these, you know.
Yeah, and that's not what we're talking about
here. We're not talking about this. And then the other way we kind of look at it, we seem to have to be bipolar with it, this kind of unreasonable thing of beauty that's not even real. Mm-hmm. And then there's the, we disregard it. Like, oh gosh, my legs won't work. Oh, my damn knee went out again. You know, it's this machine that you're mad at.
You're just constantly kicking around because it doesn't do what you want it to do. Exactly.
It's worse than taking it for granted.
Sure.
So if that's kind of what's going on, I'm not saying that's where everybody is, but that's where there seems to be a lot going on. And what there doesn't seem to be enough of is what the ancients had. So trying to counteract some of that and reinject this.
Exactly.
Really, well, I think soulful way of looking at the body as something soulful. Much more than a machine, much more than a thing of adornment or beauty.
That's a great way to put it. I like the word soulful that you use there. I think that's really important is re-injecting, you know, kind of re-spiritualizing the idea of the body. And it's a middle ground because there are schools of thought in both today and in the ancient world that this body is just a prison. And it's holding back my spirit and my soul from ascension and, you know, it's this thing that I'm trying to, you kind of, you know, get rid of. It's this mortal coil that I'm trying to slough off and get away, whatever, you know, these ideas that, that the body is something sort of dirty and,
Flesh.
And the flesh, quote unquote, and all that. But,
well, transcendence is the key. It's, we're still going to live in this flesh body as long as we're here on Earth as Earthlings.
Yeah. Well, and that's,
but it's to transcend it. We're not wrapped up in the beauty of it. We're not despising it. It's not holding us back. It still is, but
it is our
forward.
It is our vehicle, though, of consciousness, and it's an individualized point of light in the universe that we see through it for the limited time that we're in it. And so to sort of take care of it and have reverence for it, realize at the same time that the temple is, you know, material and it will crumble someday. Hopefully later than sooner, but you know, because we do want to, you know, we do want to make the most progress we can while we're here and so on. But the point is that the middle ground then is, you know, to have respect and reverence for the body, but to also realize that, you know, it's not all there is, and to not overly glamorize it or become one of these people that's, you know, constantly, you know, having to be on this diet and I've got to, you know, do this, this regimen, and I've got to take these pills, and I've got to get these shots, and I've got to get, you know, tuck and, you know, nip and tuck this and that. And, you know, you're constantly, you know, treating the body, you know, like it's something you're going to try to hang on to forever. I mean, on the other hand, you don't want to completely disregard it and crap it up and eat junk and, you know, not take care of yourself. You know, it's, it really is a, it's a middle ground, and that's where the reverence comes into play and the realization that there's more, but also that it is this particular vehicle that you're in right now, and, you know, take the best care of it you can, but also, you know, don't overly connect and hang on to it, because it will go. And that's just the reality of life. Right. But that there's something more,
something,
you know, there's a spiritual aspect to us, a spirit that, that does not die, that is never born, that, you know, what, water cannot wet it, fire cannot burn it, et cetera, as they say in the Bhagavad Gita. So at any rate, that is our summation of a very beautiful and excellent book called The Occult Anatomy of Man. Highly recommend that you read it. Also, if you desire, there is a YouTube video. It's later on, but Manly Hall does touch on some of these ideas that are in this book. It's called, if you look up Manly P. Hall, Sacred Mysteries of the Human Body on YouTube, you can find this lecture that contains some of the information, but I highly suggest going to the source and reading The Occult Anatomy of Man. And do check, listen in the future for episodes where we're going to go more deeply into this, we're going to go chapter by chapter and break it down and really, really elucidate some of it. So thank you for joining us today. Did you have anything else to add to that, by the way? I don't want to.
I think that's it. I think we, you know, kind of capped it off, introduced it and capped it off, and, you know, look at your own body, and there's a wisdom of the body. There's the Buddhists talk about the heart mind. You can have a gut feeling. You know, there's intelligence and wisdom all throughout our body, and part of our maybe meditations and detachment from the body is also listening to it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, and, you know, if we want to go, you know, go back to even, like, I'll just end us on this, this quote. I mean, this, you know, comes from, you know, Christianity and mainstream, very, you know, popular, obviously, and, you know, most well-known religion that we have in the West. In First Corinthians 3:19, Paul says, "What know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost, which is in you, which ye have of God, and ye are not your own." Ye are not your own. So, you know, the body is yours to live in, but it also has a higher source. If you can keep that in mind, it does give you some kind of security in terms of, you know, when we're worried about the afterlife and this and that, or, you know, we're worried that that's all there is this material existence. You know, Don't get fooled into that thinking. I tend to think that there is much more beyond this, and keep the faith. And it's not specifically a Christian faith, but you know the faith that there is something higher and something guiding us at all times. So, thank you for joining us this week, and please join us each week here on the Cosmic Eye Show. My name is Jason Napolitano. I'm the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, and thank you, Chris Sheridan, the author of the spirit in the sky. Thanks for joining me, Chris. I appreciate your help every week. Sure. Please join us next week and support us if you can at Cosmic Eye, cosmiceye.org. You can check us out there, or you can support us at anchor.fm/cosmiceye, or check out Chris's website, chrissheridan.com. Thanks again. Have a great week. Goodbye and God bless.